This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
It seemed too good for the old prospector to be true. For almost every year last decade, the price of gold went up every year, leading the pack in the commodity bull market, that including precious metals to the price of oil. It was quite a range. In 2001, you could have bought an ounce of gold for about $250 an ounce. By September of 2011, an ounce of gold was selling for $1,921 an ounce, a rise in price of almost 700%. And I remember, Jim, when you were talking back at the beginning of the 2000s, how this was a new bull market in metals, and people were saying, oh, no, it's not that. It's just a bubble, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, history has proven that. Otherwise, 700% in the span of a decade. For silver, the gains were just as incredible. In 2001, silver was selling at $4 an ounce. In April of 2011, the price of silver hit a peak of almost $50 an ounce. That's a gain of 1,130%. The returns in the last decade resemble the returns of the technology boom of the 1990s. And I remember that the boss that I had back then every day would come trotting out of his office to herald the new returns in the market, which he, of course, like everybody else, Jim, was going to go to the moon and never come back again. Aha. He learned, however, that all bull markets have an end. Today, the price of gold has come down 44%, and the price of silver is down over 70%. It's clear the metals, along with the other commodities, are in a bear market. So now the question is, since we've seen this rise and fall, Jim, is gold in trouble because things aren't looking good for the precious metal, even as we speak here at the end of this week?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at what's happened this year, and especially over the last, probably last couple of weeks, I mean, it's not just precious metals, John. It's the price of gold, silver, copper, cotton, and sugar, although we've seen a bounce here in the ag sector. And what we've seen this year, and especially since the beginning, is investors have been fleeing the commodity space with an increasing aversion to commodity investments. And currently, according to the CFTC, hedge funds have a major bearish bet on gold. For probably the first time on record, you'd have to go back to, let's say, the mid-decade, probably 2006. And that's according to the latest Commitment of Traders report that comes out every Tuesday. But since Q2, investors have yanked out about $1.1 billion out of commodity sector ETFs. What does that do? I don't care if it's GLD, SLV. It forces a sale into the market, which weakens the price even further.
All right, now, what do you think is driving this spike in commodities, precious metals in particular, by the way? Metals have traded in a range for the last year. Now they seem to be crashing out of that.
I mean, most of what you see now, you got to remember that a lot of this trading in precious metals is done in the futures market. So assuming you haven't borrowed money, you put your 10% down, you're leveraged 10 to 1. So a lot of short positions are being put on by hedge funds, which is what we're seeing, according to these reports from the CFTC. Other factors, I think, that are driving this, and maybe why hedge funds have gone short, slower economic growth, both here and globally, and especially in China. And of course, all of this talk, what have we been talking about all year long? We've been talking about the Fed raising interest rates and the strengthening dollar. And that's not helping. And there's also the crackdown in corruption in China, as corruption payoffs were often transacted in gold, according to our friend Louis Gav at GavCal Research. So it's not just one factor. I think it's a number of factors. When people start making large bets, as hedge funds are doing now, they're usually based on some fundamental factor, some catalyst that they see a downside, whether it's slower economic growth, slower gold buying, higher interest rates by the Fed. All of that combines together and creates a consensus or a viewpoint, and then people position themselves for that. And right now, that position has been on the short side.
Okay, so it sounds like there are a number of factors here which are driving down the price. But if you had to pick out some kind of a trend or a clear theme that's driving down the prices, what would you say is the overall theme?
I mean, if there were a couple of themes driving down prices, it'd probably be a slowdown in economic growth. People don't realize it was economic growth, and especially economic growth in the emerging world, which was a main driver of gold in the last decade. This is a topic that I've covered on the program with gold newsletter writer John Kaiser. And people keep looking at this kind of Armageddon doomsday scenario. Well, if you take a look at gold from the price of 2001 all the way to its peak in 2011, outside a short time span of, let's say, 2008 and early 2009, John, most last decade, you saw above average economic growth rates in the U.S. Now, granted, a lot of that was being driven by, let's say, an expansion of credit because the national debt, basically all of debt in the United States, doubled from around $28 trillion to over $54 trillion. So you had booming economic growth here, but even more so in the emerging world. Those were the days when we were seeing the Chinese economy, which later became the second largest economy in the world, growing at 10-12% a year. And it was this economic growth that drove the demand for gold more than anything else. It wasn't a lot of gloom and doom stuff that was driving the price of gold when it began to take off in 2001. It was an undervalued asset that had been undervalued and washed out for nearly two decades, and it got a lift. And that lift was emerging market growth. So there's one theme here. It's been lower economic growth. The other factor has been financial repression. In an era, as we see today, of low interest rates, investors, and I'm pointing mainly here to institutions, have been in search of yield. And in a yield-starved market, well, the better returns have been elsewhere.
Well, it seems the two questions come to mind. I mean, number one, since gold pays no dividends or interest in a zero interest rate world, that would seem to argue in favor of gold. Secondly, give the massive quantitative easing that we are seeing, that we've seen for quite some time now here in the U.S., now in Europe and Japan, that would also seem to argue for higher gold prices as central banks expand their balance sheets and debase the currencies at the same time. So, I mean, at one point, that would have just boded super well for precious metals, but that hasn't happened, so something's different here.
Well, let's take the first question of zero interest rates. On the surface, that would arguably be in favor for gold because gold pays no interest or dividends. But you have to look at the drivers of this market. And when you look at those, the buyers have been mainly corporations, institutions, and central banks. So in a world where interest rates are close to zero, companies like Apple, Microsoft, and Intel have been able to go into the debt market and finance debt to buy back their stock. And that yields much higher yields. A good example was, I think it was 2012, in the fourth quarter, we saw a bunch of refinancing from Apple to Intel. Intel raised $5 or $6 billion in the debt market, and they were paying interest rates on five-year debt of 1.6%. And at that time, where Intel's stock was in their dividend yield, the yield on Intel was over 4%. So they were borrowing money at 1.6%, and they were buying back their stock and retiring dividends, they were paying 4.25%. And you still see that, and it's still possible to do that today, which has financed a lot of these stock buybacks that we've seen. And then another factor, too, is you got to understand institutions, whether it's pension funds, endowment funds, insurance companies, have to match obligations. So they have to turn to whatever investment that has a higher yield. Now, whether that is stocks like utilities, staples, or real estate investment trust, or emerging market or junk bond debt, which have done very well over the last 4 or 5 years. Even central banks, as we have highlighted on this program themselves, have been buying stocks. So the very cause, even though, you know, they're the very cause of zero interest rates, they're still investing in stocks for better rates of return. So since we went into the zero interest rate environment, and that's been in effect here for what now? We're going on year 7. What did we see? Initially, the dollar fell and commodities rose. But as the disinflationary theme, lower economic growth, kicked in around 2011, yields fell and money gravitated to equities and bonds, instead of the traditional haven of precious metals.
Well, you know, when the Fed launched quantitative easing in 2009, and then there was quantitative easing number two, that was in 2010, you would expect it, and it happened. Precious metals took off. Why didn't that trend continue anyway? We had additional quantitative easing then in 2012, but instead what happened is the metals peaked in 2011, right at the end of quantitative easing two, and instead of continuing their upward trend, they've fallen ever since that time. So this is a radical difference. Something changed.
Well, let's take a look at, because when you look at the markets today, you got to think globally. In 2009 and 2010, it was the Fed that initiated quantitative easing first with the, what was it, March of that year, they announced QE1, which was $1.2 trillion. Nobody heard a number like that. So while the Fed was doing QE, the rest of the world was actually tightening. Europe was raising interest rates. China was tightening. So what did we see from 2009 to probably 2011? The dollar fell while global currencies rose against the dollar. So gold priced in dollars rose to its peak in September of 2011 when it got to 1921. But towards the end of 2011, things changed. And especially with the pig crisis, money moved into the U.S. dollar, moved into the U.S. economy and the U.S. financial markets, especially treasuries. As this crisis unfolded in Europe, the dollar began to rally. Interest rates fell even more, and dollars from around the globe poured into treasuries and U.S. stocks. And as investors, we're basically, what do? If a crisis erupts in Europe, I don't care if it's pig countries or Greece, where does money gravitate to? They go to the largest, most liquid market in the world, in the largest economy in the world, which is the U.S. And so what happened is money flowed into the U.S. as a safe haven. I don't care if it was stocks or it was corporate bonds or U.S. treasuries. And at the same time, we were seeing a slowdown in global growth. Europe went through, three recessions in the last 5 years. Japan raised taxes. Their economy went into a recession. China's economy was slowing down. And so we saw this bear market unfold and get even more pronounced in commodities, very much as we're seeing that happen unfold here in just the last couple of weeks as some of the slower economic news has come out. Now, we think that's going to turn. We'll talk about that in the second part of the big picture today. But this is one of the reasons why you saw this anomaly, let's say, in comparison to what was going on when the Fed was announcing QE1 and QE2, the rest of the world was tightening.
Well, this brings us to where we are now. As we rounded the end of Friday, prices of gold and silver were falling. Our technician this week spoke about the price of precious metals falling much further than that. There could be a rally, say, for example, or a bounce, which investors are going to want to sell.
Well, one thing I've learned over the years is to avoid a falling knife. Just as prices go to extreme in bull markets, think what happened to real estate in the last decade or technology stocks in the 90s, they also go to extreme in bear markets. My own views on prices, they have further to go on the downside. And especially with the Fed tightening, interest rates rising with no real inflation, and there's no real growth catalyst, we haven't seen that real what I call washout phase. When you normally see at a bear market bottom, the gold bugs are still holding their metals, waiting for the crash in Armageddon. And I just don't see that at this point. You really don't have that washout or puke point when individuals throw in the towel. And you still haven't seen a lot of production cuts with some of the big mining companies. You haven't seen the mergers, the collapse of a lot of the companies that have collapsed have been in the junior mining space. But I've yet to see, John, that real capitulation at this point where people walk away, dump their gold, dump their silver, and say, I never want to own gold again or never want a gold stock again. And I also want to point out, even though we've seen gold fall in dollars, it's not doing that in other currencies such as the euro and the yen. The price of gold has actually been rising. So gold, when we talk about gold here on the program, about gold falling, we're mainly talking about gold falling in U.S. dollars.
So in your opinion, we really haven't seen the bottom yet, which means that prices could drop further. Now, what might change your position on that?
If something was to change, I suspect a rise in inflation, a major financial crisis impacting the markets. As Ned Schmidt mentioned in hour one, he thinks the first rate hike will do that. And a rise in oil and inflation, and probably a fall in the dollar. And, you know, with an accelerating global economic growth, all this could happen at some point in the future, but I just don't see it happening now. I mean, what do we have? We have rising interest rates, which pose more of a problem for gold right now and not a problem for stocks, until, as Craig Johnson talked about in the first hour, we start getting into bond yields in the upper 4 and 5% range. At that level, when we start getting 5% bond prices, then that's going to be trouble for the market, just as it was in 2007. And right now, John, if I look at my Bloomberg screen, we have 10-year treasuries at 2.25%. 30-year treasuries are below 3%. So with global QE, long rates will rise slowly because, remember, as let's say the ECB practices QE, and that's going to continue to September next year, and they've given every indication that that may continue even further, the bull market in equities has a ways to go while commodity prices have further to fall on the downside, at least as conditions exist right now.
So if you looking at where we are here, would you be selling, buying, what?
You know, even in bear markets, you have rally points. You might get to a point here where you have a tradable rally at some point. But without a clear-cut major catalyst, something that would promote the price of metals over a longer-term period, just as we had emerging market growth in the last decade, you know, without that and without emerging market growth and strong growth in the developed world, couple that with rising inflation and a falling dollar, any rise, in my opinion, would be more of a trade than, let's say, an opportunity that is longer term. So it's obvious to be that this debt deleveraging process that we've talked so much and so often on this program, not only in the big picture, but also with guests that we've interviewed on the premium channel, deleveraging has probably another 2 or 3 years to go. And in this era of financial repression, which is likely to be with this for a balance of this decade, institutions, I don't care if it's pension plans, insurance companies that have to match liabilities, they're going to be looking at where they can get the best return for money. And we've seen a lot of these commodity-based investments, we follow fund flows, and we've seen a lot of money flow out of, I don't care if it's the ETFs such as GLD or SLV or even commodity ETFs in general, money is still flowing out of that sector, which means those ETF managers have to dump that metal into the market, driving down the price. And more importantly, so much what goes on in the metals market is done in the futures market, which is leveraged 10 to 1. So that tends to amplify the rise or fall of gold in either direction, depending on which direction those bets are being made. And right now, hedge funds have big bets against gold.
So to sum it all up, if you're interested in the metals, gold lacks a credible long-term catalyst. Rising interest rates and a rising dollar are further risk for metals. If gold does bounce, that may be a tradable rally, but the trend still favors in the long term right now stocks.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Come Monday, it'll be all right. Come Monday, I'll be holding you tight. I spent four lonely days in brown LA's, and I just want you back by my side.
Every Monday here at FinancialSense.com, we run a series entitled Lifetime Income. It's designed to help you plan for retirement and to manage your income when you are in retirement. It's a worthwhile series and very, very important since most Americans don't have a retirement plan to help them get into the retirement years and not outlive their assets. Here's a sample of the program coming up Monday.
Ben, you talked recently about an article you wrote called Trimming the Sails in Long-Term Care. And one thing that was really surprising in that article is the sales of traditional long-term care insurance has been dropping for years, while hybrid coverage, these are types of policies from life insurance to annuities that have long-term care riders, have been rising. What's accounting for that popularity?
Well, several things. Traditional standalone LTC policies have had some bad press lately. rates have gone up, underwriting has tightened, and a number, well, quite a few providers have left the business for various reasons. Their actuarial data was inadequate, so they found themselves paying out claims and not making enough money. Plus, they tend to hold their savings in bonds, and interest rates have been so low, they just couldn't keep the business going. So there's been bad press about those policies. At the same time, the number of these linked or hybrid benefits has increased, and they are increasingly popular for a number of reasons. The first, I guess, most obvious is people hate to think of paying into an LTC insurance policy that may never pay off. I mean, they may be lucky enough to never have an event where they need long-term care.
Come Monday, it'll be all right. Come Monday, I'll be holding you tight. I spent four lonely days in a brown LA haze, and I just want you back by my side.
Well, if there's one thing that bears and bulls can agree upon, this year has been a very frustrating one for both of them. Stocks have been all over the place, up one week, down the next. In the United States, the Dow has been back into negative territory for the year. Commodity prices have been hit, and especially the metals, as we just talked about on the previous segment of The Big Picture. There are growing arguments being made here from both a bullish and a bearish viewpoint. So what we should do here is try to articulate both viewpoints for the listeners, and then add our own views as to what is going on. So, Jim, let's begin with the bearish side.
Well, I would say here, there's really no compelling long-term bearish view to be made at this point, John. A view I see probably more often than the things that I read are probably more short-term and cautious in nature. And the viewpoint being made right now, especially given some of the headwinds we see due to, let's say, lousy government fiscal policies, we're also in the start of what you and I call the silly season. Today, Hillary Clinton talked about raising capital gains taxes to 39.6%, a mistake her husband made before reversing that policy in his presidency. But right now, you have, depending on your income bracket, short-term capital gains could be taxed at 39.6 or 43.4. Her proposal would raise capital gains to that 43.4% for the first 2 years that you would hold, let's say, an investment asset. It would drop to 35.8% in year three, almost 32% in year four, and would remain at 28% after 6 years. So, you know, the market sold off on that news. So Democrats are running on the new tax and spend. So that is probably one of the biggest negative headwinds out there. Longer term, markets never respond favorably to higher taxes, especially of the magnitude Clinton is talking about on capital gains.
Any gains from selling stock in the first 2 years would be taxed just like ordinary income. Then the rate would decrease each year until it returns to the current rate. This means that from the moment investors buy into a company, they'll be more focused on its future growth strategy than its immediate profits.
In historic perspective, Jim, her husband, Bill Clinton, raised capital gains to 28%, but then rapidly reversed that decision once the markets fell. So you have to ask yourself right now, and this is how politicians do it, they tend to all come closer to the center to try to look appealing to everybody, or they try to pander to each individual group, and if they're contradicting themselves, hope that nobody from the other group will notice. But is this pandering at this point? Because let's face it, Mrs. Clinton gets a lot of money from Wall Street. So outside of higher taxes, what other risks exist for the markets? I mean, what are the other bearish viewpoints?
Look, fiscal policy has not worked in the last 7 years. We've had anemic economic growth, but the only thing that's worked is money flowed into the stock market. So that's one thing that is going well. You don't have to be Larry Lots of Bucks. You can be an average Joe that has a 401k plan, a 403b plan if you're in the public sector or a 457 plan, everybody likes seeing their 401k plan go up every year. You start putting higher taxes. I mean, look what Japan did when they doubled their VAT tax. I mean, they sent the economy into a recession. What do you expect markets are going to do when you're saying, hey, you're going to have to hold things for 6 years to get a 28% tax rate, which is higher than where we are now? Never mind the fact that you may be paying almost 44% tax in the first couple of years. So that right there, John, alone. But once again, this may be in response to, let's say, the Elizabeth Warren and the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, which are calling for the end of corporate buybacks, attacking people like Carl Icahn, some of these other people as, you know, a real risk to the economy. This is more what I call political pandering. But once again, we're going to get a lot of this kind of stuff, and even coming from the Republican side. Chris Christie is talking about doing taxes on or means testing or phasing out Social Security. So even some people in the Republican camp are talking about taxes. And that creates what I call an element of uncertainty. And whenever you get this element of uncertainty, the markets really don't respond. They don't like that. But outside of, let's say, raising taxes, most of the other bearish views are mostly short-term focused. One view is that there's a major disconnect right now between what the markets expect the Fed to do and what the Fed is telling us they plan to do, something Ned Schmidt highlighted in our first hour today. I mean, if you look at the Fed dot plots for 2015, and dot plots, folks, if you're not familiar with the term, that's estimates by various Fed governors where they think interest rates are going to be on the Fed funds rate. The dot plot for 2015 is certainly more hawkish than what the market's view of things are in terms of where interest rates are. But the consensus in the markets right now is one and done. So whether they raise it in September, they do it in October, or they wait till December, the consensus view is they're only going to raise interest rates one time. Well, the Fed dot plot suggests two times. So it's certainly a lot more aggressive than what the markets are thinking. And there's also that other side that this could lead to a rally. Let's say the Fed doesn't go in September or even go in October. This could give us that big push that Craig Johnson talked about in the first hour. And there can be a compelling case that the market's view of not raising interest rates, but you know, you take a look at Yellen seems eager to start the process, even though going will be slow and gradual. So there's one disconnect right there is the market's view of where interest rates are going. And the market, by the way, has been more accurate and maybe foretelling what the Fed actually does than, let's say, what the Fed is planning to do. And we all know over the years, almost every single year, the Fed is always changing its forecast, whether it's the economy, the unemployment rate, when they're going to raise, when they're not going to raise, changing the language. Their forecast when it comes to the economy have been off the mark over 90% of the time.
How much do markets react to all of the electioneering? I mean, everybody knows that this is sloshing back and forth. I would think they get a little more nervous when the number of candidates is whittled down and you really have an idea who the candidates are and then what they're saying and the probability that they're going to be elected to office. I would think they get much more nervous at that point and much more reaction. So do the reactions become increased on the markets?
You know, certainly if we had some doubts on both sides of the aisle, I don't think anybody in the press or anybody else thinks that no one other than Hillary Clinton is going to be the Democratic nominee. Bernie Sanders is drawing crowds. Elizabeth Warren, it's been suggested that she run, but nobody expects that. You know, the anointed one seems to be Hillary Clinton. So there isn't any doubt on that side of the aisle. On the other side, the Republicans, I mean, there's 16 of them right now. We just had John Kasich join this week. So we now have 16 on the Republican side running for office. Nobody's taking anything serious at this point. There doesn't seem to be any clear front runner other than Donald Trump right now, who, you know, there's speculation that if he's not treated well, he may run as a spoiler in the third party as an independent, much like Ross Perot did in 1992, which gave Bill Clinton the presidency because Perot drew votes away from the Republican side. So nobody, John, I don't think is paying much attention to, let's say, what's going on with the Republican side right now. That's why they're paying more attention to what Hillary Clinton is saying, because she's obviously the front runner on the Democratic side, not even Bernie Sanders, even though he's drawing crowds, is coming close to Hillary Clinton's numbers within the Democratic camp.
All right, let's see. Fed rate hikes have been a consistent worry all of this year. Will they hike it? If they will, when? This has been preoccupying the market, subject to much debate. I'm wondering if people are actually doing pools on this one and making some bets. Anyway, what other arguments could be made for the bearish case? Now, what about the economy?
Well, I mean, that is another bearish view. The economy was negative in the first quarter, and even now that the second quarter is over, the second quarter was nowhere in comparison to what we saw last year. So the economy is really having a lot of difficulty growing above trend and expanding. In fact, in the first half, it's estimated the economy only grew at 1.25%. The forecast for the second half of the year is maybe the economy grows at 2.5%. You contrast that to last year, when in the third quarter it was almost growing at 5% and high twos in the fourth quarter. But right now, the LEIs are showing signs of improvement. They're neither a boom or a bust at this point, but at the margin, they're beginning to improve. And another factor is U.S. Treasuries look more attractive given global quantitative easing and lower yields overseas. I mean, this is something that you really see when you look at global bond markets. I mean, right now, treasuries on this Friday are 2.25%. Now, you would think, gosh, that's really low in comparison. But, you know, when I look in Europe, the highest interest rate is in the United Kingdom. They're expected to be raising interest rates similar to the U.S. It's at less than 2%. France is less than 1%. Germany is less than 0.7%. In Switzerland, they're actually negative, about the only place in Europe where you can get a halfway decent yield, and I am not recommending this by any means, and that would be Greece, where the interest rates are 11%. But if you go to Asia, Japanese interest rates are at 0.4%. They've been stuck there for over two decades. So, you know, you take 0.4% on Japanese 10-year treasuries, you compare that to, let's say, 2.25% on treasuries here in the U.S., U.S. treasuries almost look like junk bond yields in the sovereign world. So, you know, this is something that is very attractive.
Okay, now speaking of overseas, recent economic events show in Europe and Japan, they are improving. Those are reports out of there. But there is a big worry about China. I mean, this is the world's second largest economy, and it would seem to be slowing down.
Well, I mean, emerging market economic growth has been slowing, especially in China, which has been a factor in the sell-off in commodities that we've seen here, and is also a contributing force to this disinflationary trend that we're seeing globally. I mean, companies are having difficulties raising prices, and also, especially for large cap blue chip stocks that are made up in, let's say, the top 100 stocks in the S&P or the Dow stocks, it makes it much more difficult for an international multinational company, which gets a good bulk of its sales overseas. If the dollar's rising, it means those sales, when they're translated into dollars, are much lower. So that is one of the bearish arguments that are made oftentimes on earnings. But we could see that reversing itself as we get closer towards the latter part of this year.
Now, what about the fact that stocks are overpriced and have become really too expensive?
Well, I mean, stocks aren't cheap. Now, I would not argue against that view, but they certainly are not in a bubble, as many of the bears would contend. I mean, the Dow right now has a PE of 15 and a dividend yield of 2.4%, which is above what you can get in a 10-year treasury. The S&P 500 has a PE ratio of 18 and a dividend yield of 2%. Now, that certainly isn't cheap, but it's nowhere near, let's say, the PE multiples that we saw at the prior peaks on the Dow and the S&P, both in 1999 or, let's say, in 2007. I mean, the PE ratio on the Dow in 1999 and in 2007, John, got all the way up to 30. And in 20, it got up to 26 in 2007, both on the Dow and the S&P. So at multiples of 15 for the Dow and let's say 18 for the S&P, markets aren't cheap, but they aren't in bubble territory either. I mean, PEs at this level argue more in favor of a correction rather than a crash or a new bear market.
So laying out the bearish case, you believe it favors more of a stock market correction rather than a crash or a bear market. Some of the views are here, for example, there are different views on Fed rate hikes, anemic economic growth, the attractiveness of treasuries. There are disinflationary trends and higher PE multiples. Well, that would argue for caution or correction. All right. Well, we've articulated the bearish views, which argue for stock market caution and correction. You did not touch on the crash or Armageddon view, which is always there. It's been there for decades, as a matter of fact, which the bears argued for the last 6 years, which have been proven wrong. Don't see that at least for the next couple of years, barring anything that would be a black swan or rogue event. Now let's flip over to the bullish views and see how those contrast.
I want to just spend a few moments on the Armageddon view, because it was amazing to me that stock prices went nowhere for 13 years. I mean, they had their bear market. I mean, the S&P 500 hit 1,500 in March of 2000. It hit it once again in 2007, and it would not be till March and April of 2013 that we finally exceeded the previous level of 1,500. So basically, if you were invested in stocks, John, for 13 years, they virtually went nowhere. And as we talked about in the big picture, during that same period of time up to 2011, you know, gold prices were up 700%. Oil prices, you know, started out the decade around, what, close to $10 a barrel, got all the way up to 150. Silver prices were up almost 1,100%. You know, commodities in general was where the action was in the last decade. But let's take a look at that. Even though commodity prices were rising in the last decade, they weren't doing it because the world was ending. They were doing it because we were seeing explosive economic growth in the emerging world, especially in the BRIC countries like China, India, Brazil, and Russia. And that was driving this demand for gold in China. A lot of it was on the corruption side, but it was economic growth that was driving the demand for gold, not that the world was ending. Yeah, we had a war. It was a Gulf War, and now we have the war on terrorism. But these are minor wars. It's not a full conflict anywhere near like World War II, when you were actually destroying and blowing up stuff. So the drivers behind commodity prices in the last decade were not the Armageddon view. They were actually positive views on economic growth. And that's why, I mean, the bears have argued, you know, the world's going to end. All these kind of things have argued for the markets to crash. Well, they really did crash. They crashed in 2000, 2002. They crashed again between 2007 and 2009. And then there was this argument as well when the Fed launched quantitative easing, as they did in 2009, which sparked, especially with QE2, which gave us that final blow-off price in gold and silver, that with the Fed's balance sheet expanding in the way that it was doing, this would argue for higher commodity prices. But what happened? At the same time, economic growth slowed down, especially in the emerging world. Europe went into a recession. Japan's economy was slowing down. China's economy was slowing down, along with India. And then as demand for commodities was lessened, you saw a slowdown in Brazil and a lot of the commodity-producing countries, as we're seeing today. That pulled back all of this marginal demand that we were seeing for commodity prices, which weakened. But John, it wasn't the Armageddon scenario that drove prices higher, and that's why they've been wrong on this Armageddon scenario that they talked about. And even in the Armageddon scenario, the price of gold fell along with silver. The last Armageddon scenario, about the best place to be, was in cash and treasuries.
Okay, so no Armageddon, more caution in the area of a correction. Now give us the bullish view.
Craig Johnson argued many of what I would call the bullish views in hour one. And to his credit, John, he has nailed the S&P targets better than anyone we've had on this show. I mean, his target for 2350 by year end is probably an outlier out there among the strategists I follow or talk to. But I've learned to pay a lot of attention to Craig, as he has nailed it several years in a row. Now, he laid out the case rather well in hour one for higher stock prices by year end, which I'm in sympathy with. Now, whether we hit 2350, you know, Jeremy Grantham thinks that that's the bubble territory when we get up to 2300, 2400. What I'm focusing on and what we look at is sentiment. We're looking at fund flows, and right now sentiment is more on the bearish side, especially in emerging markets versus, let's say, developed countries like in the OECD countries. but I'm also watching the trend in global PMIs, which are improving, and that is arguably a bullish case for stock prices here and globally. The LEIs bottomed here in the developed world in the first half of the year, and now we're starting to see a bottoming process in the LEIs in the emerging markets, which we think are bottoming now, and I expect the economies to pick up steam in the second half of the year.
Now, Jim, you've always argued that the leading economic indicators can move markets positively or negatively. So do you expect them to improve in the quarters that are coming?
Yeah, I do. I believe you will see PMIs improve both here in the developed world and also in the emerging markets. So I expect, John, this soft patch that we saw probably in the first half of the year, especially with that negative print in Q1, will pass, and both the economy and earnings will be far better off by the end of this year. And both, and I want to make this clear, we're certainly not going to see the kind of barn burner economic growth rates or earnings growth that we've seen, let's say, between 2012 and 2014. But they will be an improvement. And as Jeffrey Sott from Raymond James has often commented here on our program, what the market really cares about, more importantly, are this question. Are things improving at the margin, or are they deteriorating? And if you look at the margin, things are definitely improving, both in the emerging world and the developed world. So right now, sentiment is very negative on global growth. We believe the bottom is in when you take a look at the developed world, like Japan, the Eurozone, or the U.S., and that should provide a boost to, let's say, emerging market economies, along with monetary stimulus that we're seeing, whether China's cutting interest rates, lowering bank reserves. Central banks are still in the easing mode and still cutting interest rates. So we believe we're close to a trough here. If we're not close, we may have already experienced one in the emerging world.
Now, what about falling commodity prices? We have lower oil prices, gasoline prices. That has to be good for consumers. And it does make the case for Fed rate hikes to be slow and gradual so it doesn't disturb that.
I mean, sentiment is negative either for, I don't care, you're taking a look at higher yields. You know, people expect interest rates are really going to go up. If you take a look at Fed rate hikes, economic growth. So the markets can turn dramatically. If those fears don't materialize, the markets can turn on a dime. And that's one of the things that we often see is, you know, when you have these expectations built in that the market expects a certain outcome, and all of a sudden you start getting surprising data, either on economic data here or overseas, or you start seeing corporate earnings, a company comes out like Amazon did this week, they made a profit, believe it or not, and you can see the market quickly turn and you can see explosive moves to the upside. So I still subscribe to the bullish view. And from our perch, we are seeing the LEIs begin to turn up. And we also think that the PMIs in the emerging world are bottoming, or if they haven't bottomed already, they're pretty close to one. So if you look at this, if the economic numbers begin to improve, what does that mean? It should lead to an improvement in earnings per share, which have been lowered to such an extent right now in the first half. So I also believe if the Fed goes, I don't believe a quarter point rate hike will make that much difference. In fact, if you look at bond treasury bills to treasury notes, the market has already priced this in. I mean, we're looking at a quarter of a point on a one-year T-bill rate. Beginning of the year, or at the bottom, it was less than 0.1%. We're looking at almost 0.75% when you're talking about two-year yields. So when the Fed raises, you compare it to the last cycle, let's say in 2004, when the Fed funds rate was already at 1%. That was the starting point. It's going to take three rate hikes to get us to the starting point of where we were in 2004. So we're starting at 25 basis points. So I don't see this to be a problem. The bears believe it will be. And I probably lean more and subscribe to Craig's view. Not until we see long-term bond rates in the 5% range are stocks in for some real trouble.
So given the fact that you expect the markets to head higher, and we've heard both of these views, where are you going to put your money now?
You know, I like foreign blue chip stocks, which offer high dividend yields. So, you know, I've been a big proponent of dividend yield investing here the last 4 or 5 years. And as I look at some of the best dividend paying stocks that were very popular at the beginning of this bull market with QE, they were utilities, which had stellar years in 2012 and 13 and part of 14. And you take a look at real estate investment trust, pipeline companies, master limited partnerships. Those were the big go-to kind of stocks for yield. But a lot of those stocks have gotten to be pricey. Utility stocks have gotten to be pricey. And REITs and utilities are more vulnerable to, let's say, rate hikes coming from the Fed. So where else can you get attractive dividend yields? Well, you can get those. You still get those in blue chip stocks. I'm still finding dividend yields over 3% in consumer staples in the energy sector. Heck, you can get over 6%. But if you want to take a look at where some of the dividend yields are much higher, you know, you look into Europe, I don't care if it's the Dow Jones Stock 50 Index. If you want to look in Asia, the dividend yields are much higher. And one of the important things that you've learned about this bull market is, in the stock market returns over longer periods of time, a good 45% or almost half of the return in the stock market has come from dividend yields. At a time when interest rates are still relatively low and almost at zero. And I mean, this year is a good example. The stock market, the Dow is down. But it's down less than 1% for the year, the S&P down slightly. I mean, if you take a look at that, you're getting a nice dividend yield of 3, 4, 5%. I mean, wouldn't you rather be getting that than rather than sitting back and waiting, you know, I hope my stock price goes up? So I still think dividend yields are going to be very important, especially, and it's not just the fact that you have an aging population here in the United States. You have aging populations, even worse, in Japan, in China, in Europe. And what do aging populations need? They need a source of income. And so dividend-paying stocks, I think, are still going to be attractive. I just find that you can find much more attractive yields by shopping overseas, even though there are some great bargains here as well.
So you're still bullish on stocks, given what you're seeing in the leading economic indicators and prefer dividend-paying stocks. And barring anything, you know, there's always something that could come up as a rogue wave or black swan event. That's the trend that we're seeing for right now.
Yeah, and just to comment on black swans, when the economy is growing, you're in economic growth mode, the markets are going up, the economy is better able and the markets are better able to absorb a black swan event than when you're in recession and in a bear market. And there's a big contrast. And we've seen this, John, over the last 6 years. How many times in the last 6 years, if you and I talked about, you know, the worry du jour of the day, recently it was Greece, before that it was Ebola, before that it was, you know, the sequester, the fiscal cliff. I mean, we've had, you know, the pig crisis, Fukushima, you know, the Arab Spring. We have had one black swan or crisis event after another every single year since this bull market began and recovery began in 2009. But when the economy is in a positive growth mode, along with the market, and you have loose monetary policy, all three of those are in place, you can absorb a black swan much better than without one. And that's why we've seen when any of these events occur, whether it's Greece or Ebola, you might see a short-term correction in the market, 5, 6%, sometimes 7. Probably the worst was the summer of 2011, where that really looked like we were heading for a recession and bear market. What has happened? The corrections have been short, they've been quick, and the market has come back. I mean, take a look at all the stuff we've been talking about since the beginning of the year. We've had plenty of things to worry about, including the most recent one with Greece, but the market correctly called the outcome. And that's why we've been in this period. So we still have a lot of uncertainties. And we expect them to be resolved as these PMIs and LEIs tick on the upside, both here in the U.S., Europe, Japan, in the developed world, as well as the emerging world going forward.
Well, Jim, GDP figures come out next week. Anything else we should watch over the coming 7 days?
You know, I'm still watching the LEIs both here and abroad to see if they continue to tick up as I expect they will. And as we mentioned earlier in this segment, we feel that the emerging market is close to a trough if it hasn't already. So we're watching the LEIs. If they continue to be anemic, maybe the Fed waits instead of September. Maybe they go in October or even December. So we're watching the LEIs, John. And we're also watching corporate earnings. We're still in the middle of earnings season. You still have a lot more earnings coming forward here in the next couple of weeks. We'll be watching which companies are beating, the ones that are beating. What are they saying about, let's say, Q3 and Q4, if those messages are positive. So earnings and economics, that will be the focus here, probably for, I would say, the next month or so. In the meantime, well, once again, we're out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the shows. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.